remain open if a certain section was shut down. The decision to drop the criminal charge against Kyles comes a year after the acquittal of three others who had also faced involuntary manslaughter charges. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
California's ban on gay marriage is triggering more protests across the country. Last night in Manhattan, demonstrators staged a large rally in front of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Temple. They're angry about the church's endorsement of Proposition 8, a referendum put to voters and approved last Tuesday. More anti-Prop 8 rallies are expected nationwide this weekend. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems. At pewtrusts.org.
Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to experience the Dresden Staatskapelle on November 15th, as well as the Takacs Quartet, Muzsikás, and Marta Sebastian on November 19th. For more information, visit krannertcenter.com. WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin this second hour of the show. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. According to recent figures, that is, figures released recently from the Centers for Disease Control, there are more than 1.1 million people in the United States living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Now, while the total number of people with HIV is increasing, new infections overall have remained stable in recent years. CDC says that that stability is an important sign of progress, although they also do caution that action to slow the spread of HIV is needed on all levels, from the level of the government to the level of the individual. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about what we know today about AIDS in the United States. And our guest for the program is Philip Alcapez. He is an associate professor of urban public health at Hunter College, City University of New York. He's also visiting associate clinical professor at the Yale University School of Nursing. He is an infectious disease epidemiologist with more than 20 years' experience researching the social aspects of AIDS, as well as tuberculosis and other communicable epidemic diseases. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions, comments certainly are welcome. The only thing we ask is that callers just try to be brief so that we can get as many callers in as possible and keep moving along through the hour. But, of course, questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Alcapez, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. The reason, I think, for us to have the conversation just to start out, I think, was with the reports that came out, and actually I think this was released maybe about 5 weeks ago or so. The numbers came out from the CDC of the numbers of individuals now living with HIV in the United States. And I suppose the headline was, on a lot of these stories, was that the estimates that we had, particularly when it came to people newly infected, we were undercounting, and that maybe for a long time it seemed like the rate was something like maybe about 40,000 or a little bit more new cases every year. And now it seemed, from what I read, CDC is actually saying, well, maybe that's more like 50,000, or maybe even in the high 50s. And so I suppose the question is, well, how significant is it that we were undercounting? And in the vast scheme of things, is there a big difference between, 42,000 new infections every year and maybe 58,000?
Well, let me answer in two parts. First of all, that's basically accurate. The CDC had been saying that there were about 40,000 new infections. So let's make a distinction. We'll talk about infections, meaning the moment when people acquire the virus that causes AIDS, and cases of AIDS, okay? And they were saying about 40,000 new infections per year. And then in this past summer, new data were released saying that the new estimate of new infections per year was more like 56,000. So a substantial increase over what the CDC had been saying before. The second part of your question, what does this mean? That's intriguing. That's a part of, I like to think of that as part of a larger question, which is, how do we know what we think we know about epidemic disease? And from that standpoint, this is an interesting juncture in our knowledge, or what we think we know, about AIDS. So how big of a difference is it? Well, I could talk about the accuracy of the estimation. I think there are potential problems. That would be a kind of technical statistical discussion. But it seems that, indeed, there are more infections per year than the CDC had been estimating before. And therefore, not surprisingly, the estimate of the number of people living with the AIDS virus had to be scaled up as well.
Well, let me ask you this question then. This estimate, does this take into account the number of people that we believe are infected but do not know it?
Yes. The new methods were very attentive to that problem. And there are a lot of statistical techniques that had to be used to account for it. But as far as I can see, they did quite a good job of accounting for that problem. That is, there are people who are infected and don't know it, don't get tested, so their test results don't, or sorry, their infection never comes to light because they haven't been tested.
Okay. So I guess that then I go back to the again the question, well, now, and of course we also have to acknowledge the fact that it takes a long time to collect and to process statistics. So these numbers we've been talking about now are several years old. We're talking about numbers as of the end of 2006.
Six, right.
Okay. So now we think that though this is a pretty, the best we can do, this is a pretty good number. We're talking about something, as I said, over 1.1 million adults and adolescents who are HIV positive, and then the annual rate of increase around 56,000 new, we're thinking that means 56,000 new infections. Infections per year.
Right.
So then how do we then think about that? Obviously, we'd like the number to be zero, but is that, and particularly if we also look at rate of infection elsewhere around the world, particularly in developing countries, I mean, how do we assess the fact that now, you know, 27 years after we first discovered this, here's where we are. We've got 1.1 million people living with HIV and an annual rate of 56,000 new infections. I mean, do you look at that and say, well, you know, we'd like it to be zero, but that's not so bad? Or do you look at that and say, no, this there's no excuse for having 56,000 new infections every year, particularly because we have a pretty good idea how you get infected and what you should do not to be infected.
Right. Should we be happy about this, or should we be bummed out?
Yes. In a word, yes.
Yeah. Well, I'll give a simple answer and then a slightly more complex answer. The simple answer is that epidemics are very complex things, and simple answers are always going to be unsatisfying. So while in some respects it is indeed good news that the infection rate isn't as high as it used to be, in others, it's bad news because why should there be transmission at all, given how much we know about AIDS and how it spreads. What I find that is that this conversation, and I don't mean the one you and I are having, but I mean the larger one about what we should make of new findings about AIDS, or as I mentioned just before, how we know what we know, is always fraught with a kind of a complexity that comes from what we expect to see, what we most fear, what we think about ourselves. As you've alluded to, the infection rates in some parts of the developing world are astronomically higher than they are here, but we have an expectation about ourselves that's different from the expectation we have about the rest of the world.
Let's just go a little bit further and talk here about AIDS and HIV/AIDS in the United States, and just to talk about who is affected. It continues to be mostly men. If you look at who these people are, most of these men who have become infected are men who have sex with other men. So that is still the most significant means of transmission. However, there is transmission between heterosexuals, and then there also is the significant number of people where the means of transmission was injection drug use. Has that particularly changed?
You've perfectly accurately described the way that the Centers for Disease Control, which is the federal agency in charge of keeping track of epidemics, has portrayed this epidemic. And there are, in that portrayal, there are changes from time to time. There have been, over the 27 years that we've known about AIDS in America, there have been changes in the relative contribution of these so-called transmission categories. They used to be called risk groups. But this is where I come to my larger question about how do we know what we think we know about epidemics. And AIDS is particularly instructive about this, because over the years we've kind of loaded, if I can use that word, loaded AIDS with a lot of our misgivings about ourselves as a society, about the way people act. And the way we've chosen to describe it is filled with those kind of underlying sensations about what we expect to see and what we fear. Mm-hmm. I've talked about this in much more general terms about epidemics in general over history in a book that's coming out this coming spring. It's called Dread. It's going to be published by Public Affairs Books. And it's really about that question: how do we tell ourselves what we think we know about epidemics? And part of the book is about this specific question about AIDS and how we've decided to define it. So there was a decision early on that we're going to define AIDS in terms of these risk groups, or transmission categories, as they call them now. The main one is men who have sex with men, and then there's drug injectors and some others. That was a decision that was based on a certain amount of fact, because we know something about how the virus is transmitted, but it also created this idea of groupings or subgroupings in American society that had a resonance for us. I mean for us as a society, that we should see men who have sex with men as a particular group with a particular linkage to the occurrence of AIDS. So my answer to your question is that I think it's a more complicated problem than just, you know, is there more transmission through male-male sex now than before, or is there, you know, more or less transmission by needle sharing than before? That picture itself is filled with expectations about our society and about how people should behave.
Well, you're right to say that this is what I'm doing is I'm literally reading off the page from the CDC.
Yes, and so, I have the same page in front of me.
Okay, well then let me introduce another piece of data here, reading off the page, that maybe again says something about what it is we think about this disease or how we think about this disease. And that is, if you look at the breakdown of incidence by race and ethnicity, we see that the people affected by HIV are overwhelmingly minority. That is, 46% are African American, 18% Hispanic and Latino, only 35% white. And apparently of other ethnic groups, tiny slivers. But the major ones are those. And the major two taken together are Latinos and African Americans. So what does, I mean, if we just look at that, what does that say? Or what does that lead us to think?
At the risk of sounding either ornery or slippery, let me start my answer by saying, as you and I'm sure the listeners know, the whole question of what race means in America, or race ethnicity means, is a very troubled one.
Absolutely.
So it ends up being a shorthand for a lot of things. And here in particular, one way to think about this is this race ethnicity breakdown of AIDS cases is that at one level it's disturbing to see an infection seem to be kind of sequestered in certain parts of the population. At another level, it's not so surprising. This has been the story of infectious disease epidemics in America, that they tend to cluster in among the have-nots. And so to the extent that America's have-nots are more likely to be black or Hispanic, then it's not so surprising that HIV, like many other epidemics, would be more common among those populations. And if you don't think about economic wherewithal or social class or where people live, and we just do this breakdown by race, then what you see is this sort of color to the epidemic.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Philip Alcabes. He is Associate Professor of Urban Public Health at Hunter College, City University of New York. He also has a visiting Associate Clinical Professor appointment at the Yale University School of Nursing. He is an infectious disease epidemiologist. He has more than 20 years' experience doing research on social aspects of AIDS, as well as tuberculosis and other communicable epidemic diseases. We're talking about AIDS in the United States, looking at some of the recent numbers that have come out from the CDC. About what we know about the incidence of the disease and the rate of increase and so forth. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let me ask you this: it is very important to acknowledge that as we think about infectious disease, who gets it, why, and then as a matter of policy, what we want to do about that. Our ideas about who is affected and what were the means of infection and so forth, that's obviously going to influence and drive policy. So if you want to try to do something different rather than just reading off the page from the CDC and look at the standard sorts of breakdowns, men, women, means of transmission, you know, who are these people, what are they doing, and so forth, is there actually another way to try to get an understanding of this disease and how it spreads and why, and then what we want to do about it?
Well, this is a great question, and so let me not be the CDC basher, and let me not claim that CDC has done some great disservice by defining the epidemic according to transmission categories. Mm-hmm. That's part of your question. You know, what else could we have done? And I think that the CDC, for reasons which made good sense to them and were perfectly logical at the time in the early 1980s when AIDS made its debut here, used the data that they had and defined things as best they could with appropriate assertions of their own uncertainty. And about exactly how this new disease was being transmitted and who was susceptible. And we've, as a society, come to embrace that risk category breakdown. Is there something else we could have done? Well, I think there are other ways we might have thought about it. I don't know how likely they were, and I'm not sure whether my saying now in 2008, what we might have done back in 1981 or 1982, will change very much how we think about this now. What should we do about this right now? Is that part of the question?
Sure.
There's, to a certain extent, epidemics are so profoundly driven by the complexities of social structure that it's very hard to make a dramatic change to drastically diminish the infection rate without making some pretty profound changes in social and economic structure. So in the sort of changes that don't happen overnight and require quite a lot of political will and take a long time. What can be done in the short term? The CDC is advocating more testing because they feel, as you know from reading their material, they feel that the more people are tested, the more people will know their HIV status, and the more people can change their own likelihood of infecting others by adjusting behavior. So that's one argument for more testing. As you, I'm sure you also know, the main focus of prevention policy in America is around prevention education or risk reduction education, goes by different names, where people are counseled about sexual behavior and using condoms, et cetera. So those things aren't bad or wrong. These new data, though, ought to make us wonder how successful they are. And this comes back to your question from earlier on, you know, should we be happy about this or should we be scared? So one of the things I took away from the new CDC finding, this was in August when they published the finding about new infection incidents. So it was that was in August, and then I think October they published the finding about the overall prevalence of people living with HIV. When they published the finding of new infection incidents back in August, what they said was that, and I have no reason to doubt this, that the infection rate has been pretty constant for the last 15 or so years. And that brings up the question of, well, do we think then that what we're doing is successful because it's not worse than it was?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we think it's unsuccessful because you'd think over 15 years that the rate would go down if our prevention efforts were being successful?
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. We're almost at our midpoint. Again, our guest is Philip Alcabas. He is Associate Professor of Urban Public Health at Hunter College, City University of New York. Has written a lot about this, and he's also done research on social aspects of other communicable epidemic diseases, not just AIDS, but also tuberculosis. Questions, welcome. We are here talking about AIDS in the United States. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have somebody here to start off with in Chicago, and it's on our toll-free line, line four.
Hello.
Yeah.
Speaking of being scared of things, I know in the recent past we were so concerned about the mad cow disease and then the bird flu, and of course we were alarmed as to what precautions we might take to deal with them, and they haven't apparently blown up to epidemic proportions. And we've gotten down to becoming more aware about sanitizing and cleansing and doing what we can. And still we have outbreaks of E. coli due to massive combinations of animals in the preparation for the marketplace. Are the status of the mad cow and bird flu and other conditions these days? Are we at a point where we should be so alarmed that the media has played it up, or should we feel a little bit more comfortable regarding those or anything else?
Should we be alarmed? Well, I mentioned this book that I've just written, which is called Dread, and the reason it's called that is that I argue that much of the way we understand epidemic disease comes from our fears about the world. But having said that, that doesn't mean that there's no such thing as danger in the microbial world. So as the caller suggests, there are a lot of things that seem pretty scary. There are these outbreaks of foodborne disease, E. coli, Salmonella. You remember earlier this year there was the Salmonella outbreak that seemed to be from tomatoes or jalapeno peppers. And it seems now that there's a big foodborne disease outbreak every year or so. And you still read about bird flu. It's not doesn't seem to be as popular as it was a few years ago, but people seem to be worried about that. Mad cow disease still around in cattle. Should we be scared? Well, that's a question for a psychotherapist, I guess. But an answer for an epidemiologist like myself is that nature is capable of terrible surprises. And in fact, the very worst epidemics that have happened have been the worst because they took everybody completely by surprise. To a certain extent, we plan for things often appropriately, and I think there's some great examples of planning for prevention that worked really well. The most recent great example was SARS, which you might remember in 2003, which barely affected the United States at all because of really good communication and planning by health authorities. On the other hand...
I say that the public health sector ought to get more funding for the good work they're doing and still have yet to do because I think they've been under-supplied in terms of revenue for epidemiological studies and pursuits and so forth. So good to hear you. Thank you.
Well, I'm all for more funding for the public health sector.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller here. Here where we are in Champaign-Urbana. This happens to be Champaign. It's line one. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Going back to 1950, when I was still in high school, in a discussion about venereal diseases, which nobody talks about anymore, they're still here, I asked, well, what about the other than... syphilis and gonorrhea and disease things. And the response that I was given is, gee, there are 80 or more unknown and at the time viral was not discussed because it wasn't known about a great deal, that simply make you weak and you die from pneumonia. Is there any correlation between the increase presently in gonorrhea and syphilis and the AIDS? And how does that relate to Abraham Flexner's studies in France about the diseases among the prostitutes? And that was funded by Rockefeller.
So let's see. So one question is there a relationship between syphilis and gonorrhea and AIDS? That part of
and then why has the term venereal disease been thrown away?
The newer term is sexually transmissible disease.
Yeah, it sounds like it has alphabet soup, STDs.
Sorry?
It sounds like alphabet soup, STD.
Well, yeah, I guess that's right.
Okay.
Sexually transmissible disease is the term that's used typically now rather than venereal disease. And... is there a relationship between what used to be called VD, which was primarily syphilis and gonorrhea, and AIDS? Yes, both because people who tend to get certain STDs, if I can use the newer term, also tend to get others, and AIDS is itself a sexually transmissible infection. And also there's a certain biological interaction that some people who are infected with other STDs may become more likely to be infected with the AIDS virus if they're exposed to it. So there are some relationships among those different sexually transmissible infections, AIDS being one of them. How does this relate to prostitutes? Well, this comes back to my point about how we think about the epidemics that are affecting us quite early on in not in the career of syphilis and gonorrhea. Those have been around for hundreds of years. But quite early on in the germ era, when it became clear that syphilis and gonorrhea were caused by microbes, attention was focused on sex workers, prostitutes, as potential transmitters of venereal disease. And the evidence is pretty equivocal. Lots of people who never pay for sex get infected with sexually transmissible infections. But for reasons with which you're probably perfectly clear, prostitutes are always vilified.
Does that, I want to, if the caller's here, are we getting your questions?
Yes, you're talking around it quite beautifully. It works. That's enough.
All right. Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something I want to return to, and I realize we, in a sense, I think we keep coming back to the same point, and how it is we think about what we're doing to talk about AIDS, how we talk about it, what we're doing to try to prevent the spread of the disease. As you say, the primary thing that we have tried to do is to do a kind of a public education campaign. And what we've said to people is said, okay, AIDS, HIV is a virus, it causes AIDS. Here's where it is in the body. Here are the activities that we know facilitate transmission. So don't do those things, okay? Fine, good luck, we'll see you. I mean, and then we were relying on people to understand that, to take that to heart and say, oh, okay, well, I guess I better not do those things because those place me at risk. Now, again, we come back to the question, if that wasn't working, would we have a whole lot more people who are HIV positive? Or does the fact that we have 56,000 new infections every year say, well, maybe that approach it's not enough, that we should maybe still be doing that, but that should we be doing something in addition to that? And if the answer to that is yes, well, then what would it be?
Well, there's no way to answer this question, alas. You know, what would have happened if we did something different? We could try different things and see if that makes a difference. But, of course, we're not about to do the kind of the clinical trial comparison where we give good information to some people and bad information to other people and see what happens, obviously for ethical reasons. What could we do that we're not doing right now? Well, social changes in social structure that that allow people to have more control over their lives might make a big difference. But as I said before, that would take a lot of political will and a lot of activity over a long period of time. Are there short-term things that we could do? We could probably do a better job of letting people know how HIV is transmitted, although it's frankly hard to say exactly how we would do a better job. Most people seem to know something about this. And I know that the advocates for prevention education will always say, well, but they don't know enough, or there's still people who don't know, and I think that's true. It's hard to say whether if we were to tell people yet more often about how AIDS is transmitted and how they could protect themselves, if that would really make a difference at the population level to how bad the epidemic is. Because I'm kind of stating the obvious here. People's sexual behavior isn't entirely under logical control.
You know, early it seemed that early on in the epidemic, people who were really concerned with promoting awareness of AIDS, also to try to get people to pay attention to it, and then also to do research on and to try to get a better understanding and so forth and so on. It seemed that one of the strategies that was employed was to tell people everyone is at risk. And while on one level that's true, that in point of fact, while everyone might be at risk, the degree of risk for some people is very high, and for other people it's extraordinarily low, so low as to almost be zero. And that, one wonders, well, that was it really the best strategy to start out saying everybody is at risk? When in fact, everybody really was not at risk, not at the same level of risk. And perhaps now we have come to the point where we understand AIDS. We know it's there. We know some people get it. But that for the majority of the population, they can tell themselves, and probably correctly, that their individual risk of becoming infected with HIV is almost zero. So what that does is that in kind of – they tried to put it on the table for everybody, but the fact is that now it's not – And the number of people who are concerned about this as an issue because they think it could affect them personally is really pretty small.
This is a great question. And I think you're absolutely right that there was a kind of collective decision made sometime in, I would tend to put it in the late 1980s, mm-hmm. that we're going to say that AIDS could happen to anybody. And you might remember not that long ago, there was an advertising campaign for American Foundation for AIDS Research, AMFAR, that said, you know, we all have AIDS, and shows a bunch of people, some of whom are famous, who, you know, don't have AIDS. But the idea was, you know, that you would recognize Richard Gere, you know, other famous people in this photograph, and therefore start to think, oh, yeah, you know, it could be anybody. But it's true that the probability that any individual is going to get infected with the AIDS virus depends a lot on who that person is, what that person does, and who he or she is intimate with. So it can't be equal for everyone. Was that a good decision or a bad decision? I think that was one of those decisions that was very driven, that decision to state that we're all at risk for AIDS, was a decision that was very driven by our misgivings, by social concerns, for instance, that if we said something else, we would be stigmatizing certain groups, and we prefer to avoid that. We don't want to say, you know, if you're gay, or that you should be particularly worried, or if you're Hispanic, that you should be particularly worried. We do say that, but we've managed to say both that, and I think this is where your question comes from. We've managed to say both everybody's at risk, and also specific groups are at risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, does fragmenting what's the practical implication of presenting the music that the message that way, or fragmenting it that way?
The practical implication.
I mean, does it somehow do they undercut each other by putting both of them out there at the same time?
Hard to say because that's what we've done. So we don't really have a good comparison. You know, what would have happened had we done something else? It seems there are people who will argue that you have to focus the risk reduction message for individual groups of people. So, for instance, historically, in the late 1980s, there's a decision made that funds should be made available for prevention education, and those funds begin to go to gay community groups. And almost right away, another decision is made that there should be separate funding for prevention education for homosexual men who are black, and separate funding for those who are white. So that's an interesting decision, since obviously the virus doesn't really know the skin color of the person it's going from or into. So, and yet the argument that was made with a certain amount of persuasiveness is that, well, people need to hear things, people hear things differently, and they hear things based on what culture they come from. So was it a good decision or a bad decision? I can't say. Other than to look at the data, and the data, as we said before, looks like the infection rate has been constant. Maybe it would have been worse. Maybe it would have been better. So what I think we might have done, what could have been different, would have been to say that there are specific groups of people wherein, you know, among which the virus is more common. And one of the things we would have said if we looked at it that way, and rather than transmission categories, we would have said, if you live in New York City or San Francisco or Los Angeles or Miami, be very careful. And if you don't, maybe you don't have to worry as much. But we didn't say it that way. We might have said, if you live in a poor neighborhood, probably more people around you have HIV than if you live in a wealthy neighborhood. Those are different messages, but we don't describe epidemics that way.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Philip Alkopes. He is Associate Professor of Urban Public Health at Hunter College, City University of New York. Also has an appointment as a Visiting Associate Clinical Professor at the Yale University School of Nursing. He's an infectious disease epidemiologist. He has done research on social aspects of AIDS as well as tuberculosis, other communicable epidemic diseases. We're talking about AIDS in America, and certainly questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to talk about something a little bit different, but certainly connected to this that we've talked about. It's interesting if you go back and you take a look at the history of significant outbreaks of infectious disease, and you go back to the point where medical science had not advanced to the point where we really understood what caused the disease and how it was transmitted, that people reached for whatever kinds of explanations were available. But something that happened was that these diseases, their spread, became to be associated with outgroups in society.
Right.
It turned out to be some of the most discriminated against and disadvantaged people in society, that somehow they were seen as they and the way that they lived were seen as the means of transmission and infection. Now we have this disease where we understand perfectly well the means of transmission and infection, and yet at the same time we still have the disease associated with – the disease is highly stigmatized and stigmatizing, and it's associated with behaviors that are stigmatized and stigmatizing. So here now we have a situation where we know perfectly well what this disease is about and how it works, and yet at the same time it has been associated with outgroups in society. And that seems to – we can't quite seem to get past that way of thinking about the disease. And I'm sure that some people would argue that's counterproductive, thinking about it the same way that we thought about in the past about bubonic plague or tuberculosis or anything else.
And I would be one of those people who would argue that it's counterproductive. And I think I completely agree with you that AIDS at the very beginning was associated with outgroups, and also – as your historical comment suggests, that wasn't new with AIDS. In fact, that's been the story with epidemics throughout history, at least in the West. Going back to the Black Death, at least in the 14th century, where Christian Europeans blamed it on Jews, and when cholera was a terrible source of epidemics in the mid 19th century in Europe and America. And cholera was repeatedly blamed on Irish immigrants. Those were the big class of the poor at the time. When polio, paralytic infection caused by a virus of children, was becoming increasingly popular and very scary in America in the early 20th century, a lot of people claimed that it came from Italian immigrants. Or some said it came from other immigrant groups, or thought it came from Black people. The history of epidemics in the West is a history of laying blame on, as you call them, outgroups. So when AIDS came, the outgroups had changed a little bit, but the tendency to do that hadn't changed at all, and we've seen it sort of get solidified in the course of the epidemic.
Well, we're coming now. We have maybe about 5-6 minutes left. I guess the question, and I'm prompted by having had the chance to read an interesting paper that you wrote a couple of years ago about how it is we think about this disease, and about the fact that at that point, this was a couple of years ago, the AIDS epidemic was
25 years old, so now I guess we're at 27 years old, and one of these days it'll be 30, not all that long ago, and not far in the future it'll be 30. And so the question that you pose here, and I'm sure a lot of people think about, is will the way that we think about it change so that we don't – I mean, we think about it as being something serious, like – cancer, for example, but we don't attach all of these various meanings to cancer that we do to AIDS, even though I suppose there are some cancers that maybe have lifestyle sorts of risk factors. Will we always see AIDS as being something apart from a lot of other diseases, maybe even something apart from other infectious diseases?
I believe that a day will come when we will see AIDS, to use the phrase I used in that in the article, you mean, as just ordinary. Mm-hmm. And AIDS isn't ordinary yet. It still means something to us, as you've said. But I think the day will come when we think of AIDS as just an ordinary disease. It's treatable. It's already treatable. It won't seem remarkable. That's what's happened with all of those other epidemic diseases. We don't really have polio in America anymore because the vaccination campaigns have been so successful. But there's still sometimes travelers might come back with cholera. Those old diseases, which were so stigmatizing in their day, don't mean that to us to us anymore. And I think that that day will come with AIDS, although what I suggested in that article that you're referring to is that it might not be until there's another terrible epidemic that we start to look at AIDS as just an ordinary infection.
Certainly one thing that has changed is that with the improvement of treatment available for people who are infected with HIV, and we now have these multiple drug therapies, it is possible for people to be HIV positive, to live with that infection, and to live for a long time,
right,
assuming that they are fortunate enough to have access to good medical care and have access to the medications. So we go from something where at one point early on in the epidemic to be told that you were HIV positive, that would be in effect a death sentence.
Yes.
And now we're at the point where we can say to people, well, maybe we can't make you any promises, but what we have is some good therapies here, and if you can take these medications and we'll do everything we can tell you that who knows how much more life you will have, and, you know, there may indeed be times when people sort of just die of old age or they die of something else that are also HIV positive. And I wonder how that changes things, perhaps, and particularly when it comes to people's sense of urgency about it, when that we have gone from the point where you got it and that was it, you were going to die and there was not much we can do, to the point where we say, well, you know, I think we can keep you alive and healthy and you can live your life for, you know, who knows how long.
You're making a great point that there's a progression in the way our society looks at diseases that seems to have to do with how normal it can be. It comes to seem. So think about people who are old enough will remember the way cancer was spoken of, or more often not spoken of, back in the 1960s or before that. That it was so dreaded that it was rarely discussed, and people died alone, and it was disfiguring. It seemed horrible. It couldn't be discussed. Now, with improvements in therapy, almost everyone knows somebody who's had cancer. Doesn't seem so terrifying. It doesn't seem so stigmatizing, and we don't have to be so silent about it. And I think we're seeing that, as you point out, I think we're already seeing that same change with AIDS. We're not completely there yet. We still associate it with those outgroups, but this is probably the kind of progression we have to go through in order for AIDS to become ordinary.
Well, and I suppose, again, some people want to argue that that might not be such a good thing if it ends up with people being more casual and engaging in high-risk behaviors, because at some level, and this may not be a particularly rational calculation, but at some level they tell themselves, well, yes, I could become infected, but, you know, there are people who are infected and they live for a long time. And so it doesn't quite have that same, that same element of imminent danger that maybe it once did. I suppose there are some people that say, well, maybe that's not necessarily such a good thing because maybe it makes people less vigilant and less careful.
Yes, I suppose that people will say that. I'm sure people will say that. And I suppose there could be some truth in it. What I notice is that contention about complacency mm-hmm. is one that officials seem to make when they've got some new program that they want to have funded and they want us to get on board with. Not always a useful program, just one that we're supposed to applaud. And so I worry when I hear someone say, you know, we're getting complacent about fill in the blank, AIDS or influenza or hepatitis. That I think that people do what they do, and most people are pretty good about educating themselves about how to be healthy and safe these days. And when people choose to take actions that go against the advice about health and safety, they usually do it with their eyes open. And I'm not sure, I'm not convinced that it's in our best interests to really strong-arm people, to interfere with people's liberties in order to prevent what some would call backsliding into complacency. So while that might be true, I think it's a double-edged sword.
So just to finish up, I don't know what would come along to really change us cause us to change the way we think, to think really differently. I suppose one thing might be if there ever is a vaccine.
Yes.
And it seems though that because of the difficulty of that, just as a kind of medical technological issue, I don't know if we ever will have one. That certainly would change things. But I guess I wonder whether you think, so if we are having the same conversation, say we'll just go out 3 years when we're at 30 years, whether we would still be talking about this and talking about how people talk about it in the same way.
I think the conversation is different now than it would have been just 5 or 6 years ago, mm-hmm. and it will be different, if not 3 years from now, than 5 or 6 years from now. I think we are moving towards thinking about AIDS as much more ordinary, and we're even, thank goodness, finally thinking about AIDS in the rest of the world and trying to do something about that, at least in the last few years. So we're moving towards AIDS, the ordinariness of AIDS. We're not there yet, but I have every reason to believe that 3 or 5, say, years from now, we'll be closer.
Well, at that point, I think probably we'll have to finish. We want to say to our guest, Philip Alcabes, he's an associate professor of urban public health. He's also coordinator for the Master Public Health Program in Community Health Education at Hunter College, City University of New York. He's also visiting appointment as a associate clinical professor at the Yale University School of Nursing. And just tell us again that perhaps we can talk about it when it comes out, but a dread, do you know when that's going to be out?
It should be out in April of 2009, and the full title is Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Shaped Epidemics, and it'll be published by Public Affairs Books.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good thing for us to talk about when that happens. So we'll say, how about we say we'll talk then in the spring?
I'd love to.
Okay. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Support for the show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Support for today's broadcast also comes from RGP Productions, presenting a poetry reading by authors Carmen M. Percival and Michael Ledoux this Saturday at 7 p.m. at La Gourmandise, 119 West Main in Urbana. Donations accepted. That's it for us here on Focus. Want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll go to the archives and rebroadcast an interview with historian A.K. Sandoval Strauss, the author of Hotel, and American history. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's turn our attention now to the markets. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 574.5. That's down 1. March, 593.5, up 3.25. December wheat in Chicago, 525.5, down 7.5. March, 545.5, down 8. December corn, 366, down 3.5. March, 382.5, down 3.75. May, 396, down 2. July, 405, down 4. November soybeans, 872, down 13.25. January, 874.5, down 20.5. March, 885, down 20. May, 9 even, down 15.25. December soybean meal, 261 even, down 540. December oil, 32 even, down 58. At the Merck in Chicago, December live cattle, 90 even, down 52.5. February, 96.